Good evening. This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday night, September 9th, 2020, on your public radio station, 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. Ahead tonight, a memoir about gun violence and how it affects us. Ozarks at Large's Daniel Carruth talks with Toni Jensen, author of Carrie, a memoir of survival on stolen land. She's a University of Arkansas creative writing professor, and her book has just been published by Ballantine Books. Their conversation in our second half hour. Arkansas's new cases of coronavirus increased with 385 positive PCR tests and another 114 positive antigen tests. At today's press briefing, Governor Asa Hutchinson announced the new cases. He says the state continues to follow CDC guidelines and report the two different test totals separately.
But it is informative to see them combined. And so if you add the 385 positive cases under the PCR test with the 114 of the antigen test, that really gives us 499 positive cases within the last 24 hours. I know that is an extra step to go through to get that total. That allows us to report separately to the CDC, but also to be transparent with the people of Arkansas.
The most recent 24 hours of testing produced just more than 5,200 PCR tests and 699 antigen tests. The Arkansas Department of Health is reporting 11 additional deaths, bringing Arkansas's total from the virus to 928. Dr. Jose Romero, the state's Secretary of Health, says seven of those deaths were reported in nursing homes, including, he says, small clusters in facilities in Beebe and El Dorado. Five counties yielded more than 20 new cases, including 42 new cases in Washington County, 24 new cases in Benton County. The state's Department of Education reports about 40 students at Pea Ridge Middle School will need to quarantine after being identified as close contacts for exposure, and about 100 kindergartners in Harrison will also need to be quarantined. Stuart Walton, the chair of the state's Economic Task Force, says that committee today heard from Mervyn Jebaraj, the director of the Center for Business and Economic Research at the Walton College of Business at the University of Arkansas. Stuart Walton says Jebaraj told the task force small businesses continue to feel the effect of the pandemic, even more so when the number of new cases goes up.
The Department of Health, under this partnership, will refer 50% of the tests that come in over to Baptist Health for their analysis, and Baptist Health will provide the personnel to operate the Thermo Fisher machine in which the Department of Health is providing to Baptist. Baptist Health will be operating this machine 24 hours per day, 7 days a week, which is a very significant commitment and, again, an expansion of our testing capacity here in Arkansas.
And the governor says a new partnership between the state's Department of Health and Baptist Health Systems in Little Rock will allow the state to increase testing capacity by 20%.
You see a corresponding slowdown in certain areas of the economy. And so it just drives home the point that these crises are inextricably really linked, the health crisis, the economic crisis, and that to solve one, we have to solve the other.
Also today, the Oklahoma State Department of Health added 9 deaths to that state's virus fatality total. 863 people in Oklahoma have died from COVID-19. You can hear more news about how COVID-19 is affecting our region each weekday morning at 5:30 and 7:30. With newscasts from Antoinette Grajeda. Governor Asa Hutchinson's press briefings can be viewed in their entirety at the governor's YouTube channel. This is Ozarks at Large. According to the Arkansas Secretary of State's office, about 42,000 Arkansans cast absentee ballots in the 2018 election. Officials say that number could double or triple as more people vote absentee because of the pandemic. Voters are being urged to vote early to ensure their ballots arrive on time, and planning ahead is just one complexity facing Arkansans casting their ballots from overseas. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda has more.
Daniel Huck grew up in Taneytown and studied mechanical engineering at the University of Arkansas. He earned his master's degree at a university near Berlin and has been working in Hamburg, Germany for the last year. When he cast his absentee ballot 4 years ago, Huck says he wasn't familiar with the process and likely didn't give himself enough time.
And I had never really gone through the process or thought about it too much until I got here. And then I think by the time I started doing the paperwork and everything, it was already kind of late in the process. So if the ballot and everything got there in time and postmarked and everything, I don't really know. But this time I feel more prepared because this year after, as it's the second time, and knowing that it takes a little bit more time, it's a little bit more complex than I had, I guess, kind of imagined. Definitely done a bit more reading and trying to kind of troubleshooting along the way here. So this time it's been better, I would say, but it's more complicated than I had originally anticipated when I moved here.
One of the first issues he encountered this time around was accessing the absentee ballot information on the Arkansas Secretary of State's website.
I was trying to go through the arkansas.gov page to see what is the state guidance on this, and there are links for it for overseas citizens and everything, but every single link associated to arkansas.gov was either blocked, or I got an error message every time and weird hyperlinks, but all the error, you know, contact us if there's an error, like none of that also works. So I couldn't even email them.
From there, Huck did some research and was able to access the Federal Voting Assistance Program's website, which had information on how to request an absentee ballot. Then he encountered another issue.
There's instructions. It comes with the printout for the envelope and the postage included on it, right? But that only works for domestic mail. So it was a little bit confusing to me. Should I still print it and put foreign postage on it? And it was not clear at all on what exactly I was supposed to do with that, because it seemed required. You have to print this thing, and there was nowhere to print that. No one does that here anymore.
Huck was able to email the site, and a representative clarified how to mail his application.
It's minor things, but to me, I read the language of the instructions, and I think, you know, if I don't do it this way, it might just, you know, everything fails, and everything has a month, you know, or weeks lag time. So if I mess up the first time, I might not be able to redo it in time.
Because of the pandemic, more people will be allowed to vote absentee. But Huck says even before the emergence of COVID-19, there was confusion about the requirements to vote absentee.
I remember last time being confused, can I actually vote overseas if I'm not military, if I'm just voting? That was a little bit confused to me. I assumed I could, but I didn't know if there's another method via going to the embassy, as an example. Because a lot of international friends, they always just go to the embassies and they always ask me, why don't you just go there? I say, because we can't.
Daniel Huck has mailed off his application and is awaiting receipt of his absentee ballot. He says he feels less stressed than 4 years ago because he's given himself more time.
This time I feel more prepared, as long as timing and mail both directions works out okay. But also on the, I guess, more personal side of it, I feel this year much more engaged, like wanting to do this and not just to cast a ballot. Like I know in Arkansas, the likelihood of it going, the election going one way or the other, it's pretty solid if you look at the numbers. Like, it, of course, people say it, like, it's not going to make a difference, but I don't think that that's a, I don't think that's something to rest on. Things do change, and yeah, I think I'm just feeling more empowered for one vote to be one vote.
Leslie Bellamy is the director of elections for the Arkansas Secretary of State's office and says if absentee voters abroad are having issues accessing the state's website, they should try reaching out to their county clerk's office.
In general, that's the fastest method. We have all the documentation on our website, but since we're not the registrar or the custodians of the ballots, it's actually quicker to go through their local county clerk's office.
Bellamy says if someone is having an issue accessing the state's website, they could also call her office and speak with their system specialist to make sure the error isn't something on the state's end. Bellamy says people have run into issues accessing their website in the past.
And sometimes it's just a matter of switching browsers. You know, our campaign finance systems had the same problem. Sometimes it, you know, if you go to Chrome instead of Safari, it pulls up. So we would be able to help that individual walk through those issues. And then if he still wasn't able to, we could get the ballot application and pack it to him through email in a different method.
Despite issues like wait times with the mail or technical glitches accessing online applications, Daniel Huck says he's glad he is able to cast his vote while living abroad.
I think I really appreciate and am a little bit curious or slash worried about the effect of all the different kind of barriers that get in the way, like every little thing that can prevent people from voting. Right. I felt like I was pretty determined this year. Like pretty small issues standing in the way. I wouldn't say anything major standing in the way of getting it done. But complexity in and of itself can be a reason why people wouldn't do it. Right. And convenience is really important for something like voting. That's something you don't do often. And at the same time, you might feel like it doesn't really matter in some cases. So all those together, I think that's the main feeling that I'm getting to is an appreciation for maybe why complexity exists, but also the downstream effects of that. It can be, you know, somewhat having kind of a chilling effect on people's wants to participate.
Absentee ballots will begin being mailed out September 18th. According to the Washington County Clerk's website, if you're an overseas citizen who requested an absentee ballot more than 30 days prior to the election, your ballot must be received by the county clerk's office no later than 10 days after the election. If you requested the absentee ballot less than 30 days prior to the election, your ballot must be received by the county clerk's office no later than 7:30 p.m. on election day. More information is available at the Secretary of State's website at sos.arkansas.gov. You can also contact your local county clerk's office. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And a quick reminder that if you can't be with us at noon or 7 p.m. each weekday to hear stories like this, you can take Ozarks at Large with you and spend time with us when you want by subscribing to our Ozarks at Large podcast. It's absolutely free, and the subscriptions are available through major podcast services like Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, and Google Play.
You can double the impact of your giving to KUAF by making your gift a challenge pledge during the on-air fall fundraiser, September 21st through the 25th. Your challenge pledge will match new and renewing members' gifts dollar for dollar and help bring new members and more money in during our on-air fundraiser. Make your support for KUAF go even further. Make your challenge pledge today. Go to KUAF.com/issue-challenge.
This is Ozarks at Large. For centuries, the treatment of indigenous people in the United States has had direct and indirect effects on our country. The forced removal of tribes is very much a segment of our part of the world. Fort Smith's history is linked to the issue, and it's part of the new documentary from Larry Foley, a professor of journalism at the University of Arkansas. The film, Indians, Outlaws, Marshals, and the Hanging Judge, will premiere tomorrow night in Fort Smith with a limited socially distanced audience, but also with a premiere on Facebook. We recently reached Larry and asked him about the film and its title, a title, he says, that has served well as a succinct description.
I'm working on Indians, Outlaws, Marshals, and the Hanging Judge. And then I don't really even have to tell them what the film is about. They know that's what it's about. Indians, Outlaws, Marshals, and the Hanging Judge. And there is an order in it. In the story, there would not have been a story as it related to Judge Parker and any of the other characters without American Indian removal and what happened after that. And then, I guess we probably could have called it, put it in any order. But then the outlaws began to move into the territory. And that meant that, you had to put in some marshals to round them up. And Judge Parker actually wasn't, he comes last in the title because there was a corrupt judge, overtly corrupt judge before Parker was hired in 1875. And, you wanted to punctuate the film with him. I thought that, it's a rather graphic title. I guess I could have been more politically correct and called it something like Indigenous Peoples, Convicted Felons, Law Enforcement Authorities, and a Frontier Judge, but that wouldn't have been nearly as colorful.
No. And one thing that we do know about this period and geography that is covered in the film is, if anything, it's colorful.
It's incredibly colorful, and at times sort of darkly comedic. It's violent at times. It's just most curious all the way through. You know, the topics include racial injustice, accusations of police brutality, Indian affairs. Sounds kind of familiar, doesn't it?
It does.
Things we're still struggling with.
Yeah, as I watched a preview of this, I thought, what an interesting time to be making this documentary.
And I have to tell you that that was not what I thought about when I launched into this, because I've been thinking about this film for a heck of a long time. In some ways, I have been thinking about this film since the days when I was a Cub Scout in the 60s, when my pack went down and toured what was then the Fort Smith Museum and included the old commissary building that's now on the side of the Fort Smith National Historic Site. And I've done various projects that kind of dip the big toe in the deep end of this story, but I've wanted to do this for a long, long time. What happened was is that all of these present-day elements have just kind of roared to the forefront, and then the timing was made perfect when I found out, and I had already jumped off into the deep end, but when I learned that, oh, by the way, being Fort Smith, we've commissioned a 12-foot-tall statue of Judge Parker. Mm. So it's like, okay, no turning back.
Especially, I think, people who grew up or have lived for a long time in Fort Smith, some of these legends have been passed to them since they were school children. But, of course, your job is to separate legend from what we can as closely ascertain in history as fact. How difficult is that with this subject matter?
Well, it was one of the intents was to do some myth busting, and there's a lot that surrounds Judge Parker and his court and those deputies and you know all the other characters, some bigger than life, some notorious. And I, as a journalism professor, and as a former reporter, I still consider myself a reporter, but a reporter of history. And I take that point of view when I'm digging into any story. There's a lot of literature to dig into, and I dug into about everything I could find, and a lot of it is myth-based. There are newspaper accounts. There are many actual quotes from Parker and a lot of the other people that were, you know, in the middle of that story. So, the research that I did was both exhaustive, and I'm talking about content and visual research. It was both exhaustive and a heck of a lot of fun. I mean, you know, in the course of all of this, we found a photograph of the gallows, of the real gallows that for a long time nobody knew it existed, because right after Parker's death, the city of Fort Smith was just sick of the notoriety of becoming, you know, the place for the hell on the border jail and the hanging judge. So by order of the mayor of Fort Smith, they burned it down. And so that was the end of that until they decided, well, wait a minute, we got something here. Let's rebuild that as a tourist attraction. And so, you know, we have the only known photograph of the gallows. I was able to work with the National Archives, and they, you know, with me just not giving up and finding a good curator, archivist, they found the letter written by Isaac C. Parker asking President U.S. Grant to be appointed judge for the Western District of Arkansas. And they also found the letter of appointment. So, we are telling a story full of all kinds of rich tales. And we are being as true to life as we possibly can be. If we make a mistake, it's not for lack of trying to get it right.
Let's set up for people who maybe don't know as much about Fort Smith and what was then the Western frontier at this time. What was life like? We've heard the hell on the border and things like that. After spending so much time and going such a deep dive into this, How would you describe Fort Smith and the land west at this time?
Well, what happened after the Civil War, and you know, we're at a time when people were just murdering each other right and left, and a lot of folks were just wiped out by the Civil War and began pouring into Indian territory. And then they decided, well, you know, we can go up to Coffeyville, Kansas, and rob a bank, or go over to Missouri and hijack a stage, and we can go hide out in Indian territory, which was, you know, now the state of Oklahoma. And get away with it, because the feds aren't going to come get us, and the Indian tribal courts and law enforcement folks are not able to come get us. So, you know, as Elliot West, the historian from the U of A, says, the whole place had just gone feral. And so that's why Judge Parker was dispatched to Fort Smith. It was on the border. Indian territory had become a dumping ground at first for the what we have known in history as the five civilized tribes, and then after, you know, over a period of time, the government began rounding up all kinds of tribes, Western tribes. You know, in Western history, we think about certain towns like Deadwood and Tombstone and Dodge City, and those towns certainly have their place in Western history. But I think I make a fairly good argument in this film that no place had the significance in the real story of the westward movement and the story of cowboys and Indians and good guys and bad guys and judges with quite a reputation. Fort Smith was right in the big fat middle of that. And here's the thing: think about two of the most well-known Western novels of all time. Fort Smith is prominently featured in both of them, Lonesome Dove and True Grit. Now, True Grit is a theme that resonates all throughout our piece, because Charles Portis, who wrote that book, that bestseller, and two movies which were later made of it, he mixes a fictional story with real-life characters. Judge Parker is in True Grit, and we quote that in the film. And George Mallet and the Hangman is in there. Portis in True Grit writes about the spectacle of a public hanging. And so Fort Smith is a great town to when you're really studying that old cowboy and Indian type period of time. Now, what we know from Western films and the old TV shows, that really wasn't the way it went down at all. I actually think the real story is much better.
Finally, the premiere is fittingly in Fort Smith. We're still in a pandemic, so there's some, you know, protocols that have to be put into place, aren't there?
Well, yes, and we wanted to make sure that we had some kind of a premiere in Fort Smith in spite of all the things that are going on. So we, on September the 10th, doors open at the Bakery District at 6:30 p.m. Everyone will be wearing a mask. There'll be protocols that make sure that we are socially distanced, and we will have a much smaller crowd than what we thought we would have had, but we just wanted to make sure we had an event. Now, doing something different for this film, Kyle, and I'm really excited about it. If you go to the film's Facebook page, Indians, Outlaws, Marshals, and the Hanging Judge, the evening at 7 p.m. on September the 10th, you can watch the event streamed, and we will put up there a link, a high quality link, a YouTube link where you can watch the film. Now, that's not going to be a one-time only deal. You want to watch the film then, that's when you're going to be able to see it, and then it's going to go dark. UA Press is distributing DVDs. They will be ready then. We'll be announcing a national streaming and broadcast deal later on, and there'll probably be some more streamings through festivals. They're likely all going to be virtual.
Larry Foley's new movie is Indians, Outlaws, Marshals, and the Hanging Judge. He is a professor of journalism and the chair of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. The documentary's premiere, including on Facebook, is tomorrow night. For more information, you can search Facebook for Indians, Outlaws, Marshals, and the Hanging Judge.
Hello, my name is Rhonda Dillard, and I'm the KUF Underwriting Director. Did you know that KUF listeners are connected at home, on the road, and at the office? Your business can connect with these listeners by sponsoring programming on this public radio station. Find out more about KUF underwriting opportunities by emailing Rhonda at KUAF.com.
This is Ozarks at Large. Raven Cook continues to provide us with new editions of Reflections in Black, researched, written, and recorded in that very 2020 method at home.
This is Reflections in Black, and I'm your host, Raven Cook. Reflections in Black is a segment dedicated to exploring the legacy of Black Americans in the United States and around the globe. Reflections in Black also provides resources for understanding and hope for all people. While a student at the University of Arkansas, I would walk through the halls of Old Main. The entry floor was filled with old portraits of previous college presidents. Walking the hallways was most of the time a disconnect for me. I'd often think, who were these men who glared back at me? And what would they have thought about me even being here if they were still president? At the end of the hall near Giffel's Auditorium, there was a painting of a man I knew. I knew that painting, I knew that figure, and felt comforted in his presence. I walked taller and stood prouder and sought to educate my classmates on who that man was and what he meant to Arkansas. Born in 1833, Joseph Carter Corbin was one of 11 children born to free parents in Chillicothe, Ohio. A young Joseph Corbin's education would take place mainly in the winter in the 1840s. Corbin would travel to Kentucky, where he would work as a teacher before enrolling in college himself at the University of Ohio at Athens and graduating with a degree in art in 1853 and a master's in art in 1856. Corbin would marry in 1866, and eventually the family would move to Arkansas in 1872, where Joseph Corbin would work as a reporter for the Arkansas Republican before going to serve as chief clerk in the post office of Little Rock. During the Reconstruction era, Black men were able to gain a foothold in Arkansas political offices, and Joseph Carter Corbin was no different. From 1873 to 1875, he would hold the position of Arkansas's Superintendent of Public Instruction. This role was significant in that it came with the presidency of the University of Arkansas Board of Trustees. The role put Corbin in a position to sign the contract for University Hall, or as most people know today, Old Main, on the University of Arkansas campus, to be built. Joseph Corbin would go on to serve as principal of Branch Normal, which today we know as the University of Arkansas at Pine Bluff, until 1902. Joseph Carter Corbin was an extraordinary figure. He spoke 8 languages and also played piano. As a mathematician, he submitted and published several articles. Along with his career as an educator, Corbin also served in many civic organizations around the community, including his service in the Prince Hall Masons. In 1905, Joseph Corbin became principal of the Merrill Public School in Pine Bluff. Sadly, Joseph Carter Corbin would pass away on January 9, 1911. But today, we celebrate and remember the incredible life and legacy of an Arkansas pioneer, in Joseph Carter Corbin.
Reflections in Black is a production of KUAF Public Radio in Fayetteville. You can hear weekly segments on Ozarks at Large, and you can find past editions at KUAF.com. Just search Reflections in Black.
This is Ozarks at Large. In her new essay collection, Carrie, A Memoir of Survival on Stolen Land, author and University of Arkansas creative writing professor Tony Jensen confronts personal experiences on gun violence, race, gender, and the environment, and the language we use to talk about those things. Last week, she spoke with Ozarks at Large's Daniel Carruth ahead of the book's release.
So, Tony, thanks for talking to me today. I appreciate it. I want to know just a little bit about the title of the book, just how you came up with Carrie and what it means with the themes that run through the book.
Sure. Well, Carrie's a book about gun violence. It's a memoir as well, so it's a personal book about gun violence. But also it has, I think, broader implications for other women and children, especially other Indigenous women and children. So I would say that the title then, it has to do with campus carry. It has to do with the things we carry when we're affected by gun violence. So there are a lot of birds in the book, too. So probably what birds are carrying around on their day-to-day flights all around town, all around the country. So, yeah, I think it has those multiple implications.
Yeah. And the first essay that you open with, it starts out with Magpie Road and birds and talking about birds. But then it's also, I want to know why you chose that essay as the opener for the book, where you're at Standing Rock and in North Dakota. Why was it important for that one to be the opener?
That one covers a lot of ground as far as thematic work, and my editor and I both felt like it was a good one to open with, given that it covers environmental degradation of land. Of course, the water protector camps at Standing Rock were about trying to get the pipeline not to go in, right, under Lake Oahe. And so linking the environmental aspect of the book, or the place-based aspect of the book, with gun violence, with personal risk, with cultural risk, with, you know, bodies being put at risk. And so I think that one, probably more than any other, encompasses all of the elements of the book. And the road's called Magpie Road also, of course. And there's a book. This is a whole book then about birds and guns and land. And so it seemed to be a good place to start. Also, the history. That conflict captured America's imagination in a way that the everyday conflicts of Native American people all over the country, you know, don't normally capture the mainstream attention. I could tell you about three or four similar protests happening, you know, all around the country and in Canada right now, for example. But I realized that those aren't making the news in the way that the protests at Standing Rock did. And so, yeah, I think that it was good to center the book thematically, and also it just encompassed a whole lot of territory.
Yeah, and there was a section in that essay, I think you say, you and we and they don't understand Standing Rock. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, that section talks about the nature of conflict itself. I mean that it's longer standing than we give it credit for. It's not this one temporary moment, this one singular conflict. It's a conflict that dates back to the founding of the country, right? This thing we call America being discovered when, of course, there were already people here. And so the notion then that Standing Rock was one conflict versus a moment in time on a continuation of the same old conflict, really, in many ways. And so they're definitely part of a pattern that goes back historically.
This book is so specific and so singular to your experience. It is a memoir, and to your being Métis. When we see something like Standing Rock, it becomes this pan-Indigenous storyline. What are we missing when we're not seeing the specific stories of Indigenous people?
Something I think that I've had to learn living in the Southeast, since I'm not from here, is that each tribe has its own specificity. I knew that already, but something about living around Choctaw, Cherokee, Chickasaw, Osage people, Creek Nation too, with the success recently in court, and all of that already trying to be rolled back by the state of Oklahoma, that's a particular struggle. Those struggles and those incidents and those landmark decisions, when they come, affect everyone. We were all, I think, all of Indian Country was cheering on Creek Nation, right, for that decision. But the particulars of the land base, the particulars of the place, their particular history is discrete and distinct even from Cherokee history, let's say, or Choctaw or Chickasaw, right? And so, you know, Seminole, all of those are their own individual stories. And something about being here really brought that home for me. I lived on Dakota and Lakota territory lands for many, many years, but I think maybe because there weren't so many tribes there overlapping. So I think, yeah, it is important to see that was the Standing Rock Sioux story, right, versus having it be a Pan-Indian moment. It was Pan-Indian in that people came from all over the country and all over the world to support the Standing Rock Sioux, but that's their land. I think, yeah, it is important to center each conflict with its particular tribe.
And a lot of this book is, it's very rooted in place.
Yes.
And it kind of follows you from different places you've lived and places that are important to you.
Mm-hmm.
How is it to write about places that you've lived in and worked in and then a place where you are living now? What was that experience like?
It's harder to write about here because even though I've lived here now 6 years, I don't feel like I know it that well. I feel like though my voice has slipped into Southern diction and affect in many cases, I don't feel Southern, and the South is still essentially very foreign to me. The other places I think I have more distance from and more of an understanding of. Most of them are out West, or most of them are the middle of the country, you know, the upper Midwest. And so I think I have a greater understanding of those places than I do maybe the South. The South is still really interesting to me, but remains a little mysterious.
And then I do want to talk about the theme of gun violence that runs throughout the book. Why did you settle on that as kind of the overarching topic?
When I started writing the essays, some of the first essays that would become the greater book project, they were all place-based, as you already mentioned, and they were all also linked by gun violence. And eventually, it became very clear, summer of 2016, I think, you know, it just seemed like 2016 was really a moment of epic gun violence. Of course, unfortunately, since then, that hasn't stopped. But 2016 was when I really started thinking all of these probably would be linked by guns and gun violence.
And another thing that's linked there is about identity and gun violence. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, Native people are the demographic most at risk in the United States for being shot, and especially being shot by police. And I think that will surprise certain people who would think that it would be Black people in America who would be the biggest demographic. And population-wise, it absolutely is Black people. But per capita, the prison population is the highest for Native people, and shootings by police are highest for Native people per capita. And rates of domestic violence are also the highest. And so it seemed impossible not to address that if I'm writing a book that includes gun violence, right? And it also seemed impossible to ignore, though, the face of gun violence right now, especially gun violence by police, is a Black face. It's not a Native face. And so to address that, not from a who has it worse sort of dynamic, because that doesn't benefit anyone, but rather from a place of lived solidarity and a place of the solidarity of the overlap of our stories since the beginning of the founding of this country.
And then another way that you talking about identity in the book struck me was, I think it one of the sections you were talking to a friend who said she was part Métis, and it was you parsing out which part of you and how we talk about identity and the language we use when we talk about how we identify.
Yeah, she was a friend who passed away who had talked about being part Kiowa. And I grew up with her. Of course I knew that. But it was the way that she used the language of the partial. Generally, Native people, when we speak about ourselves, unless we're explaining ourselves to non-Natives, say we're Kiowa or we're Métis. That language of the partial isn't how it works. It's not an ethnic identity. It's a citizenship. The partial isn't really a factor. You are or you aren't. And so that language of the partial is a carving up, in my view, that serves others. That's not an internal designation, but rather a performance for the exterior, for the outside world. And so, yeah, it was sad to me that she was carving herself up in that way.
Yeah. And does that affect how you employ language when you're writing or when you think about yourself and how you identify? Does it change the language that you use?
It's an interesting question because I'm sure there was a moment where I decided that, but maybe not. Maybe it's just always been that way. You know, when I hear different kinds of language from other people, especially younger people, it calls to mind that question of who are we identifying for and for what purpose? I remember I was reading somewhere and a young Native woman in the audience later put on Twitter that I had said something about that there was no need to carve ourselves up like that. The ways that we identify should be for each other and not for others. And I hadn't even remembered saying it, but I thought, yeah, I do feel that way. And that was the first time maybe that I became conscious that that's just how I address those issues.
And then another part of the book is that if you wrote some of it during the pandemic.
I did.
How is it to write about being isolated and being in quarantine and going to the grocery store with a mask on and all of these things that seem normal or normal-ish now?
Yeah, we were in edits for the book, and there's a chapter in the book, late in the book, called Contagion. And I just thought, and my editor agreed, there's no way to have a chapter called Contagion that talks about contagion theory in relation to gun violence and not address also the very real coronavirus contagion that we're all contending with. So that chapter then was revised pretty late, obviously, since the book's already coming out, to include some of those pandemic concerns. And then other chapters were revised too, even later, to include the killing of George Floyd and the subsequent protests all over the country, because I've lived in some of those places. I've lived in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and it seemed very strange to me to be writing about gun violence and police violence and not include that incident, especially because my brother lives in St. Paul. I lived there. It's a place I love and have a lot of friends and family still. So I think that revising the book in coronavirus times and writing part of it in coronavirus times, as well as the subsequent protests that are springing up everywhere, it's been very interesting. I don't know that it's so much been difficult, but I think we're all, or many of us anyway, are having difficulty focusing. And so the focus part, the actually putting your attention wholly into something like you need to when you're working on a book, is a challenge for everyone, more so probably for people who don't have the great privilege and luxury of working from home. You know, I mean, I think it would be impossible or very difficult to have a job where you go out and you risk your physical health and safety every day, and then you come home and you try to work on a book. I think that would be an immense challenge. I'm sure there are people all across America right now doing that very thing, but I feel really lucky to be in the position I am where I can work from home.
And then how is publishing the book now and doing press for the book, how has that changed?
A friend was texting me last night about how all of that was going. And I said, well, the main thing I enjoy about doing a reading is traveling to different places and seeing and meeting different people, people I haven't known before, or seeing old friends, that sort of a thing. The same with conferences where you sometimes promote your book. And so I'm trying then to reinvent this experience to look for ways that it can be fun or interesting, not just for me, but for obviously the people in the audience too. Because I think there are people who don't like the in-person, who are really loving this virtual. I am not one of those people. And so I'm trying to figure out a way then, yeah, to have that be something that I enjoy.
And I did want to ask too, because this is such, it's a memoir, it's so personal. When you were writing it or when you're now publishing it, mm-hmm. How does it feel to kind of give up some of those really personal things? I know some of the essays were published before, mm-hmm. but how is it to now introduce that to a wider audience?
Yeah, people are asking me that. And honestly, before I wrote the book, I made my peace with all of that. It was a decision. The first couple of essays, the first one, I think, to be published in a broad way was The Women in the Fracklands, which is the first chapter of the book. Now it's revised, it's changed, but in writing that very personal essay and putting it out broadly, it got really a lot of hits. I decided after that, then if I was going to continue to do this, that I had to think about where my boundaries were in relation to my own life and my own stories. And those boundaries, I mean, it's all in there, really. I mean, I didn't hold much back. For me, what's been harder is thinking about other people's stories. So my family members who were in the book and their reactions, other people who were dear to me who were in the book and their reactions to having some of their stories that intersected with mine made public. I changed people's names. But still, yeah, what gave me the most pause was the sharing of other people's stories in relation to mine, not necessarily my own.
And so what do you hope people get out of the book when they read it? What do you want people to take away?
There's a lot, too, about language and the language we use to talk about our experiences with guns and gun violence. And I do hope that people take away that some of that language is not serving us. And there could be a cultural shift in language in the same way we've had cultural shifts in language about other issues. Domestic violence, for example. If someone shoots and kills his whole family, even if there are eight people in the family, that's an act of domestic violence. We don't call that a mass shooting. So those links have been talked about before, but I do hope by sharing these very personal stories that people will begin to rethink that narrative and also to connect it back to the beginning of the country itself, how the country was taken from Native people at gunpoint. We don't talk about that very often. We talk about removal like it happened politely versus that it was an armed conflict and not everyone was armed. And so I think those are some of the things I hope people will take away from the book.
That was Toni Jensen speaking with Ozarks at Large's Daniel Carruth. Her essay collection, Carrie, A Memoir of Survival on Stolen Land, is out now from Ballantine Books.
The Peel Compton Foundation presents School Days, an online educational series. Video, interactive activities, virtual tours, and more will align with the Arkansas Department of Education curriculum standards for fourth grade students. Registration and free content available at peelcompton.org. KUAF is supported by Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art, now open with limited entry, timed tickets. The museum looks forward to welcoming patrons with new safety protocols in place. Ticket reservations and online resources, including virtual reality videos, available at crystalbridges.org.
And before we go this Wednesday night, another thank you to everyone who came by the Carver Center for Public Radio at 9 South School in downtown Fayetteville today to drop off more donations of PPE. You can put it in the bin that's outside of our front door. We then bring it in, it gets sanitized, and then gets distributed to teachers and schools. It's all put under our giving tree that usually goes up in December but went up in the summer this year so we could do this drive of donations for PPE. Again, thanks everyone. And if you'd like to make a donation, you can at any time. That bin is outside through the night. We are at 9 South School in downtown Fayetteville. This is 91.3 KUAF. Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Hinesville. 91.3 KUAF is a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. Contributors tonight included Antoinette Grajeda, Daniel Carruth, and Raven Cook. Timothy Dennis produced our show, as well as tonight's edition of Reflections in Black. Our theme is written and performed by Daryl Sean. You can learn more about Daryl at his Facebook and Instagram pages, also at darylsean.com. His most recent CD is titled Safe in Sound. We'll be back with you tomorrow at noon for a Thursday edition of Ozarks at Large. As I mentioned before, morning edition, tomorrow morning beginning at 5. Tomorrow morning at 5:30 and 7:30, news of our state and region with Antoinette Grajeda. Tomorrow morning at 6:30 and 8:30, the Community Spotlight with a focus on area nonprofits, hosted and produced by Pete Hartman. If you'd like to know more about what we do, you can always go to KUAF.com. We also have a schedule there of all the programs throughout the week and the weekend. Please take care of yourself. Get rest when you can. From the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio at the Carver Center for Public Radio, I'm Kyle Kellums. Take care of yourself. Talk to you again tomorrow at noon.